Last week, we had the privilege of looking at the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ to encourage our heart on Resurrection Sunday. And so it's been 2 weeks since we've looked at the book of Matthew, and we're in Matthew chapter 26, and we're going to be finishing that up today. And as we look back in Matthew chapter 26, we saw where Jesus had finished praying in the garden. And as he finished and as he was talking to his disciples, Judas came along with the great multitude of people to arrest him. And we saw Judas, his ultimate betrayal of Jesus, with a kiss. And he told the people who he brought with him that the one you see me kiss, and by the way, as we looked at that, it was kissing him over and over and over again in his feigned love for Jesus in his ultimate act of betrayal. He was telling them, this is the one to arrest. He is the one. And we also saw that Peter, in his brashness and boldness, takes out a little dagger knife and wants to stop all of this from happening. And all he ends up doing was cutting off the ear of the servant of the high priest, Malchus. And of course, Luke 22:51 says that Jesus immediately healed his ear, a miracle that really goes basically unnoticed by most of the people in that crowd. And you remember, Jesus told Peter three reasons why I want you put your sword away, and we looked at those in some detail 2 weeks ago. But the third reason that he told them about in verse 56 was so what everything that was written by the prophets about this time, about what was happening to me, Peter, we have to let it happen so the scriptures will be fulfilled. And of course, as a result of everything that did take place, the end of verse 56 said that the disciples forsook him and they fled, just as Jesus told them that they would, just as Zechariah wrote and said that they would, strike the shepherd, and the sheep will scatter. And they certainly did. So we want to pick it up in verse 57 to see what happens to Jesus after they lay hold of him, after they arrest him. So look at verse 57 there. And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. Now keep in mind, this is well after midnight. This is probably around 2 in the morning when Jesus is being arrested and being led away to Caiaphas and the others who had already been assembled together. In the middle of the night, they're being assembled together for a specific purpose, as we shall see. And because of that, I have to stop here for just a minute. And I have to explain to you the setting here so we understand what is taking place in the life of Jesus after they laid hold on him to arrest him. Because what they are about to do to him is in violation of everything that they say that they believe. As we see here, we see the high priests and the scribes and the elders, they are assembled together. What this is talking about is an official assembly of what's known as the Sanhedrin. It's a word that means the sitting together. These people are sitting together as a judicial system in a courtroom setting about to look at Jesus Christ. This is a council of the religious leaders, typically formed by about 23 men, 23 priests typically. And sometimes when they have a larger congregation, more things to deal with, and especially those capital punishment cases, they could have as many as 70 of the elders meeting together with the chief priest. They're gathered together, and they are responsible for the judicial practices and the hearings of Israel. Both the civil and criminal hearings that will be brought before them, they're the ones that make all of the decisions about what takes place. And by the way, this judicial court has a very high standard to hold to when it came to the decisions that they were called to make. Listen to what Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 through 20 says. You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribe, and they shall judge the people, listen, with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just. That's what this council was called to do. Unfortunately, by the time you get to Jesus, this judicial court system, including the Sanhedrin, including all the council that was gathered together, were perverting justice. They were showing partiality. They were taking bribes, and they were twisting the words of truth. When you have somebody like Herod the Great putting that person that he wanted in that council to influence the rest of the council and the decisions that they were making. When you talk about the Roman government themselves wanting to interject their man or men into this council to influence the decisions that were being made by this very council, in some ways, this very council, these Sanhedrin, were very corrupt and dishonest. Not only that, but by the law of Moses, according to Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 15 to 21 that Gary read earlier, there was a law to protect someone who had to stand before this council from the false witnesses. There was a law in place that you would not have false witnesses testifying against somebody. There was a law in place, and they were to uphold that law to keep that from happening. And for whatever reason, if these false witnesses were to give false statement, and the person that they were lying about was found guilty, then they would, because they witnessed falsely, suffer the same punishment as the one that they were testifying against. As a matter of fact, in Deuteronomy 17, verses 6 and 7, it says, "Those witnesses who testify against the accused, and the accused is found guilty, their hand shall be the first to put him to death." So you see what happens if you witness falsely against somebody, you were supposed to be the one to help put them to death. But if you were lying about them, you would be the one that would be put to death in addition to the one that you were lying about. And this was all, as Gary read earlier, to bring about fear in the lives of the people to keep them honest when it came to the courtroom setting. In this legal process, according to the rabbinic law, if somebody was sentenced to death, as they were planning on doing with Jesus, that sentence of death could not be carried out for 3 days. After that verdict was rendered, they had to wait 3 days in order to carry out that sentence. And during that time, the very next day, after they rendered that sentence, then the council was to spend the day fasting and praying about that decision, also waiting for any other evidence that may have not been brought before, to be brought before them now, so that could help them to affirm that they were making the right decision. And then the third day, they would meet again and affirm the decision of being guilty. And not only that, but the law of the Sanhedrin protected a person from self-incrimination. In other words, a person's own confession about a crime, no matter how convincing it was not sufficient in and of itself to convict a person. Listen, our laws today go by a lot of these laws that they were carrying out back in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. There had to be corroborating evidence for somebody to be found guilty. They could not do that on their own. No matter what they say, they could not be found guilty. And by the way, according to their own law, the law of the Sanhedrin, they could only meet during the daytime to conduct their judicial business, especially when it comes to a capital punishment case, and they could only carry out that judicial sentencing and that whole process in the temple. And once it was carried out, according to John 18, verses 29 through 31, if it was a death sentence, they could not carry it out themselves. They had to bring that verdict to the Roman government to get permission or to ask the Roman government to execute that person on their behalf. I had to tell you all that because that has to set the scene for what's about to take place here. And you can see what happens in spite of all of this to see how absolutely wrong this whole setting is. And so we go back to verse 57. And those who laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. And by the way, in the parallel account of this in John chapter 18 and verse 13, we learn that Jesus was taken to Annas, the other high priest, before he was brought to Caiaphas. And as I shared with you before, Annas and Caiaphas were kind of co-leaders, co-high priests, and they kind of ruled together, with Caiaphas being the one that was out in the open, and Caiaphas was kind of and Annas was the one kind of behind the scenes. And so they take him to Annas first, and then to Caiaphas. And interestingly enough, Annas hated Jesus, because Annas was also the ruler of the temple and had control of all the money that was being exchanged in the temple. All the examination of the animals that had to be set forth before the sacrifice. You remember, we talked about that before. When somebody would bring an animal in, they wouldn't accept it. And they had to buy one from Annas's cohorts that were running the temple. And they were making all of this money. And all the buying and selling and trading that was going on in the temple, Annas was in charge of. And you remember what Jesus did on two separate occasions, John 2 and Mark 11? He had gone into the temple and he had cleansed the temple, turned over the tables of the money changers, scattered all the animals, scattered all the people to leave. He called his father's house. He said, you were making this a den of thieves, a den of robbers, of which Annas was the head of. And in cleansing the temple, Jesus put a huge financial dent in Annas's money that he was making. And so when Jesus came to him, Annas hated him, but he could do nothing about it. So he talks to Jesus, doesn't get anywhere with him, and so Annas sends Jesus to Caiaphas, where we pick it up in our passage here. And he takes him to Caiaphas, where the assembly of the scribes and the elders, they are already assembled. And verse 59 says the chief priest and the council were all gathered together, and they were gathered together in Caiaphas' house, Luke 22:54 says. So this is at night, in the middle of the night, in somebody's home where this trial is about to take place. This would be a violation of the Jewish law that said all capital cases had to be tried in the temple. They had to be tried during the daytime with witnesses around. And then all of a sudden the scene changes. Look at verse 58 of Matthew 26. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat down with the servants to see the end. So you have Peter following Jesus at a distance. Now, I don't know if he followed him to Annas' house too, and then when he left there, he followed him to Caiaphas' house. But in any event, when he gets to Caiaphas' house, he's following him. And it would be hard not to follow him, because there was probably, like we saw before, 1,000 or so men that came to arrest Jesus, then they took him to Annas, then they took him to Caiaphas. So all he had to do was follow the crowd, and he could kind of blend in there because he didn't want to get caught. They all scattered before. He didn't want to be approached by any of this. And as we saw a couple times ago, looking at the end of Matthew chapter 26, they did end up catching him. They end up confronting him, and he denied Jesus. So you have Peter following at a distance, and he sits with the servants in the courtyard of Caiaphas' house to watch what's going to happen. Then look at verse 59. Now the chief priest and the elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death. That was the sole purpose of this judicial meeting together, was to put Jesus to death. But because Jesus is innocent of any wrongdoing, the chief priests and the elders and the council, they had to use false witnesses to come up with some kind of charge against him. They're in essence trying him without any charges against him. And they've already convened this council illegally to try to convict him, and they're using false witnesses to do it. And we've already read about what happens to those who bear false witness. The very Old Testament law, the law of Moses, that they were to uphold, especially in judicial settings when they want to seek the truth, when people are supposedly violating the law, their sole purpose was to put Jesus to death. They weren't seeking the truth. They were seeking his death. They were parading all of these false witnesses before the council. As a matter of fact, in the parallel account in Mark 14, verse 56, it says, "For many bore false witness against him." But listen to this. It goes on to say, excuse me, "But their testimonies did not agree." And that's what our passage here says in verse 60. "But found none." All of these false witnesses came, but they found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. None to corroborate anything that Jesus could be charged for, and certainly nothing worthy of death. And all these false witnesses were willing to do that. And you think about that. Every one of those that came before this council and willing to perjure themselves, willing to lie before the council, knowing that if Jesus was found guilty, and knowing that these were all false witnesses, they should have all suffered the same death as Jesus. But we know that this council must have talked to them to tell them, "Listen, that's not going to happen to you, but we certainly need something to put him to death." You see how corrupt and dishonest they are when they're carrying out this sentence? The religious leaders and the judicial rulers of the nation of Israel are going to these extremes because they wanted Jesus dead. But look at verses 60 and 61 there. "But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days.'" And notice that these two men are identified as false witnesses who speak with the intent of saying something that the council could use to put Jesus to death. And notice what they say. They say that they heard Jesus say, "I am able to destroy this temple of God and to build it in 3 days." And in the parallel account in Mark 14, 58, they tell the council that Jesus said, "I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." Well, is that what Jesus even said? Well, in John chapter 2, verses 16 to 21, we know exactly what he said. And that was in the context of Jesus going into the temple, cleansing the temple, turning over the money changers and all of that stuff. And then the Jews, the religious leaders, some of them, when Jesus tells them in John chapter 2 and verse 16, "You're making God's house a house of merchandise," they say in John 2 and verse 18, "Then show us a sign. What gives you the right to do this and say this?" So John 2 and verse 19, this is what Jesus says: "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then in John 2 verses 20 and 21, the Jews answer Jesus and it says, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? Was that what he was talking about? No, the next verse goes on to say this: "But Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body." So these two false witnesses, like everyone else according to John chapter 2, are thinking that Jesus is talking about the temple of God in Jerusalem when he wasn't talking about that at all. They were making a false assumption about what Jesus was saying. And these two false witnesses also said that Jesus said, "I am able to destroy this temple, and I am able to rebuild it in 3 days. He didn't say that at all. He said, "Destroy this temple, and I will build it in 3 days. He wasn't talking about the temple of God. He was talking about the temple of his own body that he would raise from the dead 3 days after he died. And by the way, if you were to provide information to the council, you had to have the place where you heard that, the time where you heard that, and the context in which you heard that. And there's no record of that for these two false witnesses here before this council. But it really doesn't matter. Listen to what Mark 14:59 says about these two false witnesses. But not even then did their testimony agree. It could not be used to try Jesus for any crime, especially the crime being put to death. They could find nothing against the sinless Son of God. One writer said this, "The ones who were ultimately on trial that day were those who stood in judgment of the perfect, sinless Son of God. That tribunal of sinful, unjust, and hate-filled men will one day stand before God's heavenly tribunal and themselves be eternally condemned to the lake of fire." He's absolutely right. So what do they do next? Look at verses 62 and 63 of Matthew. "And the high priest arose and said to him, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?' But Jesus kept silent." So the high priest is frustrated now because morning is approaching and they've not concluded this mock trial, and people are going to start wondering, why are all you gathered here together in a place where you shouldn't be doing this and holding this court trial? And not only that, but their preparation for the Passover was about to take place, so they had to leave and get all that taken care of. So they're under a clock here. And he's getting frustrated because they're not able to come up with anything. So what the high priest is trying to do is to get Jesus to incriminate himself, something that the law says you cannot do. They were calling Jesus to do. So they ask him, "Why doesn't it matter what these allegations are against you?" And of course, Jesus knows that every one of these testimonies was false and inaccurate, certainly not worthy of death, and certainly not worthy of responding to. So he kept silent. He did not say a word against these accusations. And can you imagine how his silence spoke volumes to the guilty consciences of those who are sitting there judging and all of those false witnesses who were there by him not saying a word? Well, the high priest, out of just plain frustration, says at the end of verse 63, "Jesus, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." The high priest is demanding Jesus to answer this question under oath. It's not the under oath that you and I think of today when you're in a courtroom setting, you know, when they tell you to raise your hand and speak the whole truth and nothing but the truth. This is not what he's talking about. Caiaphas is demanding Jesus to answer under oath before God the Father, and him hearing what he is about to say as being the absolute truth. "I am holding you under oath that what you are telling me is the truth. And my question to you, Jesus, is this: are you the Christ, the Son of the living God, or not?" And of course, if Jesus says he is, then they would consider that blasphemy, and he could be put to death. According to Leviticus 24:16, "Whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall be put to death." And in their eyes, him saying that he is the Christ, the Son of God, would be blasphemous, but only if it were true. In the case of Jesus Christ, it is true. It isn't blasphemous. He is the Messiah. He is the Son of God. As a matter of fact, he has even said that several times in his ministry. You remember back in Luke chapter 4 when he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and they gave him the scroll and he opened the scroll to the book of Isaiah and he read it. "The Spirit of God is upon me and has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, heal the brokenhearted, all of these things. And then he hands the book back to the attendant, and he sits down, and all the eyes were fixed on him, and he says, today, this is fulfilled in your hearing. And what he was reading was from Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2, that speaks specifically about the Messiah, and he is saying, I am the fulfillment of that passage in Isaiah. You remember when Jesus met with the woman at the well? John chapter 4, verses 25 and 26. They're conversing back and forth, and the woman finally says, you know, I know when the Messiah comes, he will reveal all things. And you remember what Jesus said to her? I who speak to you am he. I am the Messiah. And you remember just a few days ago, before all this was taking place, when Jesus came in triumphantly into the city of Jerusalem, they were hailing him as the Messiah. So Jesus is the Messiah. And not only that, Jesus identified himself over and over again as the Son of God, as God being his Father. Remember back in John chapter 5, verse 17, Jesus told the Jews that were there, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. And it goes on to say the Jews sought all the more to kill him because he said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. So can you see why Caiaphas would want to ask this question and see what kind of answer Jesus is going to give? If he says, I'm not the Son of God, I'm not the Messiah, then he's denying God and everything would fall apart. If he says he is, then we've got him because he's blaspheming and we'll put him to death. How does Jesus answer that? Look at verse 64. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And by the way, in the parallel account in Mark 14:62, after Jesus was asked that, he said, I am. I am the Christ. I am the Son of God. And there is no question about Jesus' claim to deity and being the Messiah because he calls himself that here. He often called himself the Son of God. And you know what Jesus does, interestingly enough? He says, I am the Messiah. I am the Son of God. And by the way, hereafter you will see something. And what he does, he quotes two different verses in the Old Testament. He quotes Psalm 110 in verse 1 and Daniel chapter 7 in verse 13 and combines those two together. In Psalm 110 verse 1, it says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, which is a reference to the Messiah, God the Father, and God the Son, the Messiah, in the context there. And it's the context of God judging the evil people and judging the nations. They also quoted part of Daniel 7:13 that said, behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. And in that context there, he's going to the Father in heaven, receiving the kingdom on earth, the one that he will have dominion over forever, and the one that he will judge the people in those kingdoms. So he is identifying both of those passages, talking about the Messiah as pertaining to him, the Son of Man, who is coming someday to judge this world. So think about that in light of the courtroom setting here where he himself is being judged. The one who is being judged will one day be the judge of those who have falsely accused him and of all of those who have denied him. So how does the high priest and the elders and the council respond to his answer? Look at verses 65 and 66. Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think? And they answered and said, he is deserving of death. Again, in a courtroom setting like this, Jesus could not incriminate himself. Yet because of this blasphemous, at least in their eyes, statement that he's made about being the Christ, the Son of the living God, they use that as a basis of putting him to death. And so you know what the high priest does? He stands up, and it says he tore his clothes. In a feigned pretense of grief and indignation about the name of God being blasphemed, when in reality he was standing before the Son of God in human form and blaspheming him. And by the way, just as a side note, Leviticus 21:10 says the high priest was never to tear his priestly clothing. And the only time that would be allowed is when somebody blasphemes the name of God. And if they did do that, then they had to go back and sew it up where they tore it so they could use it again. The foolishness of all that went on there. Whatever outward appearances Caiaphas was putting on with his contrition and his act of indignation and anger, he was inwardly rejoicing that he could now put Jesus to death in spite of the illegal, unjust trial that was taking place. So Caiaphas says to the council, what further need do we have of witnesses? Well, he didn't have any need of those witnesses in the beginning anyway. They were all false witnesses trying to come up with something to put Jesus to death, and they couldn't do it. So he says, look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think? He talks to the council, the ones who will render the decision as guilty or not guilty to adjudicate this case or of whatever the verdict might be. The problem was that this council was set up to adjudicate a case where there were no formal charges even brought against Jesus. None of them should have been there. None of them should have been talking about any of this. So, of course, their answer would be, as was already predetermined, he's deserving of death. And by the way, according to Mark chapter 14, verse 64, in the parallel account of this, when they asked them for their verdict, it says it was a unanimous verdict to sentence Jesus to death. Now listen to this. According to the law of the Sanhedrin, if you have a unanimous verdict, the person was to be released. The reason being is that they would feel that there would have been not enough of an element of mercy in the decision that they made. It's really far different than what we do today, isn't it? But of course, this isn't a courtroom setting where they're acting in accord to the legal system set down by the law of Moses and by their own rabbinic judicial laws and everything. So they find him guilty. So how does an unbelieving court of law and a council who has abandoned all truth react to a verdict by a corrupt council? Look at verses 67 and 68. And they spit in his face and they beat him. And others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy to us, Christ. Who is it, the one who struck you? Can you imagine the Supreme Court of the land, the religious influence on the nation of Israel, the judicial court tasked with enforcing the laws, coming up with the truth, not taking bribes, dealing with false witnesses, acting like that? First of all, they spit in his face. By the way, Numbers 12:14 says there would be 7 days of shame for somebody doing that to somebody else. It was an insult. It was contempt to spit in somebody's face or on somebody's property. But they didn't stop there. It says some of the council, some of the people beat him. And by the way, that word beat means to rap with the fist or hit with the fist. And probably part of the way they did that, according to Luke 22:64, is they blindfolded him and struck him on the face. And while they were doing that, both in Luke and our passage here say that they said to Jesus, while he's blindfolded and while they're punching him in the face, prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one that struck you? If you're truly the Christ and you know all things, tell us, who's doing that to you? Luke 22:65 in the parallel account says, and many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. The one who is being accused of blasphemy, but truly is the Son of God, God in human form, is being blasphemed by the council before him. And what this council did and will do to the Son of God really is indicative of how the nation of Israel has rejected Jesus as their Messiah, in part because of the religious leaders leading them astray. This nation of Israel and the leaders in particular, the priests and all the Sanhedrin and all the people that are supposed to minister to this nation, are like Isaiah 9:16. For the leaders of the people cause them to err, and those who are led astray are destroyed because of them. Matter of fact, Jesus called them, in Matthew 23:16, the blind leaders of the blind. And as a result of this leadership, in their judicial process, in their civil process, in their worship, in everything that they did, they were blaspheming the name of God, and they would suffer the results of that in just a few years. God's judgment would fall upon this nation that rejected their Messiah through all of their feigned religion and all of this legalism that they were involved in. In 70 AD, Titus Vespasian and the Roman army would come and completely destroy the temple of God. And millions of Jews would die as a result of this, all because they were caught in this religious system, this feigned judicial system. And the one thing that they wanted to do was to kill Jesus. And you want to know something? We're not far from that today, are we? When an ungodly government and those in authority over us and those in religious positions of authority are leading our nation to blaspheme God more and more, to violate God's word more and more, to deny Christ more and more, to deny God more and more, to deny the word of God more and more, to call good evil and evil good. And we as a nation are beginning to reap the consequences of our blasphemy against a holy God and against his Son and against his word. But we can't just all blame the government and false religious systems that are out there, because every one of us who individually reject Jesus Christ, who reject the gospel, who reject God's plan, we too are in essence spitting in his face. We are all guilty of blasphemy when we take the Lord's name in vain. When you think you're good enough to get to heaven and the work of Jesus Christ on the cross was all in vain because you could work your way to get to heaven. That's the lie of the devil. Those who are striking Jesus on the face while he's being blindfolded and saying, tell us, who is the one that struck you? You want to know something? Someday when that individual stands before God and is cast into a Christless eternity in hell, the last words he'll hear is, you are one of those. You are one of those. He knew. And yet in his grace and his mercy, he didn't destroy them right then. He will know exactly who, even today, still spits in his face, still beats him with their words and their actions, still blaspheme him today, still rebel against him today, and one day too will have to stand before that great judge, and he'll say, depart from me, you worker of iniquity, I never knew you. And think about this. The whole time that Jesus is listening to all of these false testimonies, all of these things being said against him, all of the blasphemy that's going on, he doesn't say a word. As a matter of fact, 1 Peter 2:23 says, when he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he committed himself to him who judges justly. Isaiah 53:7 says, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He didn't have to defend himself. He committed himself to him who judges justly, and that is God the Father, and he did and he will. He went to the cross, he died, he was buried, he rose again the third day, and he ascended to the right hand of the Father, the foundation of the world. He looked beyond the cross to all that he had in the glories of heaven with his Father once again. And he did all of that for you and for me. Aren't you glad that he kept silent and didn't open his mouth to try to defend himself?